Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hard work and a good attitude will only take you so far in the workplace. If you really want to become king of the jungle, or maybe just survive, you should start paying attention to the Planet of the Apes, says our guest this hour, journalist and essayist Richard Conniff. In his new book, The Ape in the Corner Office, this longtime nature writer and sometime executive says, "You groom my back, I'll groom yours." That's one of the cardinal rules of the wild and of the realm of the cubicle. And that office politics are, in fact, primate politics. This hour on Point, the primate imprint in what goes on in your office. You can join the conversation. Is it a jungle out there in your workplace? How do you make sense of your own place in the pecking order? Of who attacks and who retreats and why? Can you believe it's monkey business? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Richard Conniff, award-winning journalist and essayist whose work has appeared in Smithsonian Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, and National Geographic. He is author of The Natural History of the Rich, a field guide. His new book is The Ape in the Corner Office, Understanding the Workplace Beast in All of Us. Richard Conniff, welcome.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, it's great to have you. So what qualifies you to tell us about our primate ancestry and how it may play out in the office place, Richard?
Well, I've spent quite a long time writing about animal behavior, and I've done that for National Geographic and Smithsonian, mostly in the Amazon and Africa, places like that, fairly exotic, fairly removed from the ordinary workplace. But I began to realize a while back that I was seeing the same behaviors in both worlds.
You're saying that the drives and predispositions bequeathed to us by our long evolution, first as animals and later as tribal humans, about fear, anger, the primordial yearning for social allies and status, straight down from the primates, all playing out in the American workplace today?
Yeah, we are actually still primates. We are 98.5% genetically identical to chimpanzees. And while there are enormous differences. Our brains are triple the size of a chimpanzee's. There are also a lot of similarities. You know, we talk about what are those things that make us unique and different from other animals, but there's so much more that we have in common that that's what we need to be talking about.
And what's the advantage of looking at how people get along in the workplace through this prism of chimps and apes and silverback gorillas?
Well, I think that because we don't understand ourselves as animals, as primates, we suffer from a lot of myths. For instance, the myth that we're rugged individualists, or the myth that gossip is bad, or the myth that conflict should be avoided at all costs. There are also myths that are embedded in the language of corporate life. For instance, never apologize, never explain.
So Take us into the workplace, the way, as you see it, Richard Conniff. How do you begin to see these patterns play out?
Okay, so most people think that workplace life is about naked aggression, crude social dominance, and rugged individualism. They also think that's true of the animal world. For instance, chimpanzees are said to be societies dominated by demonic males. But when you actually look at chimpanzees, for instance, they can be pretty brutal to one another. They can be rotten. But when you sit down and do the numbers, chimpanzees spend 5% of their day being antagonistic to one another, and they spend 15 to 20% of their day grooming one another. And so, you know, you start to think that we pay too much attention to combat and that, in fact, the subtext of our life, the sort of general experience that we have is actually pretty good, pretty positive.
So, I mean, you go back at the beginning of the book and cite the book by Richard Dawkins decades ago now, The Selfish Gene. Richard Dawkins has been a frequent guest on the show, and you say people interpret his kind of genetic insights and evolutionary insights to narrowly, to understand that, in fact, yes, we're heirs to the natural kingdom, and that means that it's necessarily dog-eat-dog or ape-berate-ape, and you find that that's not, in fact, the case in the primate world.
No, I think that that idea is one of the most misinterpreted ideas of the last 30 years, and it's been one of the most destructive in terms of business behavior. You know, what Dawkins meant was that the business of a gene is to get as many copies of itself as possible into the next generation by whatever means. And he has protested ever since that he never meant to say that selfishness was the best way to do it. But that's what people take it to mean. They think that, you know, being selfish is not just a matter of economic convenience. It's also natural. And if it's natural, why be shy about it? So, you know, why not make WorldCom a personal piggy bank for Bernie Ebers? Or why not devote a company, Tyco, to the purpose of giving CEO Dennis Kozlowski a birthday party for his wife, featuring an ice sculpture of Michelangelo's David spouting Stolichnaya?
Mm-hmm. Vodka at the party. I mean, are you suggesting that that a misinterpretation of the instincts that may be back in our evolutionary past has what made the American workplace, the corporate world, rougher, ruder, cruder than it used to be?
Yeah, well, and also that we emphasize the rough and crude things. We emphasize the conflict. You know, if, let's say after 3 months your company goes into the black one day, well, people may not think that that's much to talk about. But if somebody steals somebody else's client, then they leap on it. That's something that gets your attention. So we're built to focus on the negative. You know, when psychologists do these tests, they show a grid of faces to people, and they're all smiley faces except for one frown, and people instantly zero in on that frown. If you're a corporate manager and you do an employee review, you'll say four or five nice things about an employee and one quibble, and people fixate on that quibble. And that tendency to focus on the negative is pretty rooted in our evolutionary past. A few years ago, I was in Botswana, and I was traveling with a troop of baboons, and I was quite close to them, and we came to a water crossing.
Was it a package tour?
I was with some researchers, some biologists, and they had habituated these guys. And so we were traveling on foot. We were unarmed, and if they went into the water, we were going to have to go into the water with them.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty panicky moment for everybody. Mm. And the baboons gathered on the shoreline, and they were, you know, they're grunting as if they were considering these horrible possibilities. Mm. And so I argue in the book that what was going on there was not just an important moment of decision-making, but the primal decision, that during our evolution, we had to approach water holes so often, you know, with so much trepidation, yes, so much bloodshed, that it became burned into our genome, that you know, we look for trouble, we look for negatives everywhere we go, and so we tend to see them more often than we see the positive things.
But still, the water hole is a place of danger, and I suppose the raise or the promotion at the office is the new water hole. So is that what keeps that dynamic going?
Well, we actually have this negativity bias, as psychologists call it. We also have a positivity offset, which is what enables us to go forward, to approach the watering hole, to take the job promotion, you know, to elbow our way to the bar, to do all these things that we need to do rather than shut the door to our office and hide under the desk. So it's a kind of a dynamic, and you know, we're constantly fighting the negative impulse and trying to figure out whether it's safe to go forward.
Okay. Yes, please.
Well, every time you go into a meeting, it's a little bit like going to a watering hole. You know, you're wondering, it's just in the back of your mind somewhere, am I going to get eaten alive here, or is this going to be okay? So you know, people need to recognize that skittishness that's sort of a part of everyday working life.
Okay, start to walk us in here more specifically. You call the book "The Ape in the Corner Office," so you kind of begin with the boss as the the silverback big ape kind of mythology. Look at bosses, a boss that you've been, a boss you've worked for, Andy Grove at Intel. How do you see the primate dynamic working out there? Is it as the stereotypes suggest?
Well, okay, the stereotype is that it's all about naked aggression, that it's all about instilling fear in your employees, that it's about being fairly heartless. If you look at the primate world, there are at least two types of leadership style. You know, there are brutal, aggressive alpha chimps. They get their way basically by force, by biting in places that they shouldn't bite. But there is also another style. For instance, there is a chimpanzee being studied in Tanzania, an alpha named Entologi. And the way he ruled was when there was a hunt, he would take the meat and he would avoid eating it himself, and instead he would hold it out to his allies and his subordinates and let them eat first. It was a kind of pro-social or benign style of leadership, and it enabled Entologi to remain in power for 15 years until he died. So, you know, the example of the brutal boss is not necessarily the only way to do it, either in the natural world or the corporate world.
And yet, they don't call it the silverback ape for nothing. I mean, do the apes not achieve dominance by cowing others down, beating their breasts, being brutal when the chips are down?
Yeah, that certainly can happen. I'm saying that it is a combination of the two, that you need to know you can't lead successfully over the long term only by fear, only by beating people down, because that only provokes resentment. And you get employees who are demoralized. You get employees who suffer pretty profound biological changes. So, for instance, their stress hormone levels are continually elevated when you rule that way. And over the long term, that affects all kinds of other things. In fact, chronic stress over the long term can actually produce cell death and atrophy in a portion of the brain called the hippocampus, which is vital for learning and memory. And so, you know, if the employees in your company are walking around looking a little bit brain dead, well, there may be a reason. And it may be you, you know.
We hope not, but we're listening. Richard Conniff, we've got to take a short break here. Stand by. We're talking with nature writer, journalist, essayist Richard Conniff about his new book, The Ape in the Corner Office, Understanding the Workplace Beast in All of Us. You can join the conversation. Is it a jungle out there in your workplace? Are we still apes at heart when it comes to getting along? And have office politics sunk so low that we can now learn from apes? Or is learning from primates, apes, just an honest path to our own instincts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about office politics and the primate imprint on human interaction. My guest is Richard Conniff. He's author of the new book, The Ape in the Corner Office, Understanding the Workplace Beast in All of Us. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Dr. Doolittle is in. What's your question on animal instincts and the life of your office? And is your workplace a zoo? Tell us your story. Have we evolved? What's the evidence? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Conniff, hierarchy comes up again and again when people think about humans and offices and, for that matter, animals. I want to look at hierarchy. You spend a lot of time focused on the former head of Intel, Andy Grove. Why does he grab your attention? Help us see these issues through Andy.
Well, Andy Grove was one of the most successful corporate leaders of the last 30 years. I mean, he built the best company of the computer chip era, Intel, and he's interesting because he did so much of it with fear, and I think maybe a heavy-handed use of fear, and so I kind of cite him as an example of someone who antagonized workers needlessly, even though he knew better in some part of his mind.
So he built the best company of the internet, of the chip era, you say, but you don't like the way he did it. Is there a contradiction? I mean, it worked. So who's
yes. Yeah, that is a contradiction. I mean, there are people who are pretty brutal leaders and they run successful companies. Hank Greenberg at AIG is another example. You know, if you'd invested with him a long time ago, you would have made a lot of money. But in the long run, Hank Greenberg had a downfall and he's now out. And I think that more often than not, people who rule or lead brutally tend to suffer downfalls.
And yet you say that hierarchies are nature's way, that the talk about flat organization, which has been so popular in the last 10 or 20 years, you're saying, no, nature suggests that doesn't actually work. You're going against a lot of business school thinking there, Richard Conniff.
Yeah, there is this myth of the egalitarian company, and every company, including Intel, puts this myth out there. You know, Intel said that they had no executive dining room, no special parking for anybody. Everybody worked in a cubicle. But the truth is that at every company, even the most nurturing company, there is a hierarchy. People often don't see it. Even when they're in the middle of it, even when they're conforming to its rules, but it's there. I'll give you a small example. I was at a Connecticut company, a very nurturing company, and all the employees there had emails like janedoe@widget.com. Hmm. But the founder of the company, his email address was imme@widget.com.
Oh, my gosh.
any question there?
Abe roars. The breast is beat.
So let me say why I think hierarchy is actually a good thing. It evolved. I mean, it's part of our nature as primates that we're constantly paying attention to rank, and we really value these little perquisites that come with rank. They're part of the reason that we work a little harder to get a little bit further ahead. Let's, you know, chickens, for instance, probably don't much like being in the middle of a pecking order. But when they do studies, they find that chickens actually fight less and they lay more eggs when they have a stable hierarchy. And that's actually one of the surprising things about hierarchies. You know, we think of them as a source of conflict. But once the hierarchy is established, once you've gotten over those rough introductory moments, then hierarchies actually keep the peace. So that's what they're really about.
So you don't want the Andy Grove kind of brutal top dog or top ape, but you do want hierarchy. You're describing a kind of benevolent hierarchy and saying nature is the model for that. Is it really?
Yeah, and there is, in any ape or monkey society, there is a definite hierarchy. When I was with those baboons in Botswana, for instance, you know, they had social intelligence. It wasn't just a bunch of monkeys to them or a bunch of apes. When there was a fight, for instance, they didn't just pay attention to the fight. They didn't just pay attention to the victim. They turned around and looked to the victim's brother to see if he was going to come rushing to the rescue. And they not only knew about those kind of social connections, but they knew where other individuals fit in terms of political alliances or friendships or family connections. And they behaved very politically. They behaved in a Machiavellian fashion because of that knowledge.
But you don't think that you simply have to roar to make it happen, seems to be the message you're bringing us there. We've got a lot of people raising their voices from cubicle land or maybe beyond. Richard Cunniff, I want to begin to invite them in. Gwen is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Gwen. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you.
Yeah.
My question is, I work in a I'm a librarian.
Okay.
And it's a predominantly female-dominated profession,
mm-hmm.
and the particular organization I work in is also female-dominated. So there's a real dearth of silverback apes, if you can imagine.
Is that true? You're saying women don't play that role? Is there a different dynamic, you think, because it's all female?
I think there is a different dynamic, but I wondered if there was a similar model. You know, and maybe we do find ourselves taking on more of that kind of role, but it just seems different to me.
Does it mean, Gwen, in your experience, that there's less conflict or that's simply less about roaring?
I think there's less roaring and there's more subterfuge.
Subterfuge. Gwen, stick with us. Richard Conniff, what about it? Is there an ape equivalent of a female staff at the library?
Well, sure. There are plenty of bonobo monkeys, for instance, are a female-dominated society. Probably not such a great example to talk about, since they achieve peace by sexual exchanges, basically.
Between genders?
Any combination whatsoever in bonobos. Okay. There's no limit.
It's going to be a wild library if you're going to insist on that.
They're very friendly animals. But even within any within chimpanzee societies or within baboon societies or other species, there's a male hierarchy and there's also usually a female hierarchy. It's separate, but it's nonetheless pretty powerful. In fact, some researchers argue that even in chimpanzees, which are supposedly ruled by demonic males, females actually wield considerable control because they form these important alliances which can influence which male actually gets to get power and whether he keeps it or not.
But do we have here, in Gwen's example, an illustration of a kind of circumstance unlikely to occur in the natural world? Because humans can organize themselves in any way. We can build libraries and, for whatever reason, populate them with female librarians. Maybe we can't find a model because in nature you're always going to have the males around somewhere in the organization.
Yeah, that's right. We are far more flexible than anything in the animal world. And so, you know, nature is not always a perfect model.
Gwen, thanks for your call. Karen's calling from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm curious how you explain male bosses who seem ambivalent and almost kind of don't ask, don't tell.
A male boss that doesn't want to respond to questions or doesn't actually lead. What do you mean, Karen?
Both, and almost intimidated by some of the women. The office is mostly women, but these are government offices, and this is like my third job that I've run into this.
When you've got a kind of a quiet Buddha for a boss who doesn't really do anything?
Yeah, very nice, but not too much direction.
Karen, stick with us. Richard Conniff, what do you say to Karen here?
Well, we were talking before about skittishness and negativity bias, and that's a problem for everybody in the workplace, but it's particularly a problem for a lot of managers. They're afraid to do anything. They're afraid to commit to anything because they're afraid to be held responsible for it. Obviously, there's considerable variation among individuals in the human world as well as in the animal world, and so I'm not sure what to tell you about how to deal with that kind of behavior.
Karen, let me ask you, do you think that he's afraid to interact with female employees, or is this way with all his staff?
All his staff, most of his staff is female. But the strange part is he actually is a retired colonel, which would lead one to believe he'd have more
command presence.
He
should be crisply barking orders.
Yeah.
It sounds like you'd like to hear something from him.
Yeah.
Anything. Wake up, man.
Yeah. I'm nearing retirement, so it doesn't really matter. I've just always been curious why I keep having the same type of bosses.
I wonder, Richard, if it's that males in our society, they're secure in their position, whether or not they're leading in some settings. So they why expose themselves? Why not just ride it out?
I don't know. He doesn't sound secure. And a lot of people that I've known who have retired from a career in the military life find that once they're outside that very hierarchical, very orderly structure, they're a little bit lost. So that may be part of what's going on. I wonder also what the structure of your company is like and whether the people above him are encouraging or brutal.
Karen?
This is government. I wouldn't call him brutal. I wouldn't call him either one. It almost is, there is an ambivalence all the way up the line, actually.
Oh, boy. It's not FEMA, is it, Karen?
No. It
doesn't sound like the office that I'd like to depend on when the great flood comes.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have to here, but it is, it's just interesting. They can't seem to even come up with a good budget for our government here.
Karen, I think we'll put you in charge and expect something different. Thanks very much for your call. Let's take another call. Anne is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. What do you think?
Well, I'm thinking, unfortunately, it's all in line with the last two callers. I have a very dear friend who's extremely intellectual, a very high-achieving corporate person, and she went to the Yale School of Management, which is a little different in that they focus a lot on perhaps more liberal slants and nonprofits.
Yeah, right.
I think that's generally the gist there.
Exactly, yeah.
And so how I know that she's had issues not with being a manager of male, but with employee relations, because she is very strong, but she's also so insightful and in tune, which would be classically women attributes. And how does that play out? And I guess I was trying to get at the same question as the gentleman, as the answer before, in what examples in the natural world would you find of females, and it's not just giving sexual favors.
Right. Not just the little monkeys there. And stick with us, because you do put it in a different light here. Richard Conniff, if we look to nature for models, I mean, again, correct us where we're wrong, but in nature, very often, at some level, it's males that end up in dominant positions. So how is a human, a Homo sapiens, supposed to look over to that realm and take guidance, particularly if we're talking about female managers, of whom there are many very successful ones now?
Yeah, in fact, my experience has been that the female bosses I've worked for have been better than the male ones generally, because I found that they were more supportive, that they were less likely to draw a line in the sand, and so I'm not quite sure what the problem is with this boss. That she sounds ideal, insightful, and knows what she wants, and strong. What's the problem,
Anne?
Well, another part to this is she happens to be very tall, blonde, and gorgeous. So she's battled with the fact whether or not she's perceived as smart as she is at times.
Yes.
I wonder if the question in part, Richard, here is whether this is a place where humans have transcended the sort of gender role legacy from the ape world.
There are still issues from our animal past that present a problem for women. For instance, women are built to smile more. And we don't know why.
Physically, literally built to smile more? How so?
Yeah. Well, we don't know whether this is genetic or whether it's the result of having to deal with surly males all their lives. But the smile muscles that run down the cheeks, basically, are bigger in women than in men. And so the standard mode for women is to smile a lot. But if they smile a lot in the workplace, they tend not to get taken as seriously. And if they don't smile at all, or they smile too little, then they get taken for being not very nice. And so it's kind of a dilemma that women have to deal with. Same as the dilemma, you know, there are all kinds of rewards for looking good, but there are penalties that you pay too.
Anne, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call here. Tony's calling from Boston. Hi, Tony, you're on the air. What's your workplace doing for you?
Hi. First of all, I'm really enjoying the topic, and thank you for a very interesting conversation.
Great.
My question was regarding the Baka in Africa, and they have a completely non-hierarchical society.
What are the Baka, Tony? Are you there, my friend?
Baka, the pygmies.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm.
And they have a non-hierarchical society, so they have an essentially flat organization. So how does that fit into the theory,
Mr. Conniff?
Yeah, I argue in the book that there is no such thing as a flat society. That even within supposedly egalitarian societies, there are hierarchies. They may be shifting hierarchies so that in some circumstances, you know, the best hunter is in charge or takes the lead. In other circumstances, maybe the elder who is the lead in a religious sort of ceremonies or rituals. I just don't believe in non-egalitarian societies. I've never been in one with human beings.
I don't believe in egalitarian
societies. Mm-hmm. I think that there is always some level of hierarchy and rank. I think that's just our nature.
Tony, do you take the same lesson?
Well, actually, yes. I know in Baka society, that's exactly what happens. The best hunter will lead for the hunt, but that the roles are fluid, that the hierarchy isn't cast in stone, so that you don't have one person in charge, one individual in charge all the time. That leadership shifts depending on the situation and the context.
The flat organization theory in more trouble here. Richard?
Well, and in fact, we do the same thing in the workplace. You know, the person who's in charge in one department then goes to another and is third or fourth in line, and we're very flexible about that. Somebody who is a corporate titan becomes a member of the board of directors of another corporate titan, and he's suddenly very subordinate and submissive. That's something that animals can't do.
Tony, thanks for your call. Gossip, Richard Conniff. You say gossip is good, and it has a kind of a parallel in the ape world.
Yes. So everybody says we should stamp out gossip, that it's bad for companies, but in fact it is human nature, and I argue that it's primate nature. In the animal world, we've talked about this grooming that goes on constantly, 15 to 20% of the day for chimpanzees. And what they're doing when they're grooming, you know, they're not really that dirty. There's not really that much, that many insects to pick out of one another's hair. What they are doing is forming social connections and political connections. So, for instance, in some species, a subordinate will groom an alpha 10 times for every one time the alpha grooms back. And so there's all kinds of bonding that's going on when they groom. And the theory that's been put forward by some anthropologists is that humans evolved language essentially as a replacement for primate grooming behavior. We know too many people, and generally they don't want us picking insects out of their hair. So,
so we chat, we gossip.
We gossip.
But the result may be the same, a way of touching. Richard Conniff, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. What do you think? Are changes in the economy pushing us to our higher selves or back down the ladder? Is this Who Moved My Banana? Seven Habits of Highly Effective Apes? Do you hear your office described here? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about office politics and the primate imprint on human interaction in the workplace. My guest is Richard Conniff. His new book is The Ape in the Corner Office, Understanding the Workplace Beast in All of Us. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Richard, you write about conflict. Of course, there's conflict any place that people get together, and for that matter, apes as well. What's the lesson you take from the ape world when it comes to office conflict?
Well, there's another myth that conflict is always bad and it should be avoided at all costs. And you get a lot of managers who will go out of their way to avoid conflict. But in fact, conflict is healthy and it's part of our nature. To take a primate example from humans and other apes, when a mother is weaning her child, that's a moment when there's a heck of a lot of conflict. You know, the mother denies the baby the breast, the baby beats his head against her, and they resolve it, and they find some way to go forward. And you know, the mother gives the baby other forms of food and consoles the baby, and they find their way to some successful outcome. So in the workplace, conflict happens when we are at the beginning of a project, when we're not quite sure what direction it's going to go in. And so it's important to get people to stand up and say, you know, I think that's the wrong idea, and here's why I see these problems as a result of it. But, you know, you talk about those things, you fight about them a little bit, and then you find a solution. You know, you find a way for everybody to sign on.
You write, though, that among apes, this was interesting, there's the equivalent of an apology waiting out there when and if offense is taken in their primate community, and that apes are very quick to give that. What is an ape apology sound or look like?
Well, so apes are not rugged individualists any more than we are. They are part of a group, and being a part of that group is really important to their survival. So when they have a fight, they will console one another or they'll make some conciliatory gesture. The scientist who first observed this was Franz de Waal, and he's a primatologist. He was watching a fight. The two animals went up into a tree afterwards, and as the dust settled, maybe 10 minutes later, one of them reached out his hand to the other with his palm raised, and it was a sort of gesture of conciliation. The two of them came down from the tree. They embraced one another, and de Waal called this reconciliation, which was a word you didn't use in animals then. Since then, other researchers have identified forms of reconciliation in dozens of species, from dolphins to hyenas. And these reconciliations are a way that the group, the social network, holds itself together through all kinds of conflict.
So extend that olive branch, and by evolutionary link, your colleague is likely to accept it and be more likely to have a good relationship going forward.
Well, the funny thing is that because of this animal research, human researchers have also started to recognize how important apology is. And I argue in the book that what is going on when we receive an apology is a biological reaction, and it's pretty profound. I talked to a law professor, for instance, who spent one afternoon fretting about something stupid that her husband had done, and that evening she was starting to give this kind of outraged speech that she'd been rehearsing all morning or all afternoon, and suddenly her husband abjectly apologized, and the wife said, wait a minute, I'm not finished being angry yet.
but her anger may have been draining away.
Oh, yeah, her body told her differently. It's this kind of profound biological reaction, and we feel this incredible sense of relief when somebody apologizes and says, hey, you know, I screwed up. I shouldn't have let that happen.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And off goes the tension, off the clenched fist, maybe even in the jungle. Lynn is calling from Somerville, South Carolina. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi. I work for a large, relatively large residential treatment center, and we changed owners a little over a year ago.
Yeah.
And there's been a change in some of the administrators, and the amount of interdepartmental conflict has just really risen. And I'm wondering, I think in a lot of the primate communities, they're not that big, but when you get a couple hundred people involved and you have a lot of interdepartmental conflict, and when you're relatively low on the hierarchy,
yes,
you know, what can you do to manage your personal stress and to help the organization?
All right, Richard, how about it? When it scales up to human corporate scale and when leaders get, you know, thrown in and out of situations presumably much more quickly than they would in the wild, does the parallel still apply?
Well, you know, especially when one company takes over another, you have each of them has its own hierarchy, its own prestige structure, and boy, when they clash, it can be pretty rough. And usually the company that has less prestige suffers the most from this kind of a takeover. You know, I think the best thing to do is to be political, to look to who's important to you in your job and to take care of them, to make connections, to groom people, to flatter people if you need to, because that's normal workplace behavior too. And you know, show your face around, get yourself known. Those things are all sort of important tools for survival.
But you write that in the primate world, primates also find strength in numbers, that if they don't like what they see going on above them, they'll kind of join into a chorus and change the behavior of the hierarchy heads.
That's right. They can defeat their alphas, or they can influence the behavior of their alphas by forming social alliances, political alliances. You know, three or four subordinates who get together and say, hey, you know, we really don't like the way this is going, can dramatically alter the behavior of the boss. Of course, going to a boss and challenging in that fashion can be pretty risky behavior too, so you want to be careful of exactly how you go about that.
Read the Jungle Book carefully, Lynn. Thanks for calling. Kevin's calling from Bolton, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Hey, quick observation. I'm a consultant. I'm in and out of many organizations,
yes,
large and small.
Yeah.
And I find that there is this healthy tension, believe it or not, between subordinates and leaders, where subordinates think that they're ready to be leaders, and yet their comfort zone is being told what to do, what the priorities are, and then having a regular schedule every day, knowing what to expect is huge in terms of providing people a sense of their purpose.
You're saying you see followers who imagine themselves leaders but don't really act like leaders? Is that what you're saying, Kevin?
That's exactly true. There's this conundrum and there's this out-of-perspective view they have of themselves and what they can contribute when they actually find themselves very comfortable in that zone.
Gosh, let us pick that up. Richard Conniff, I don't want to get too deterministic here. I mean, humans have ambition and they want to be leaders. Kevin's suggesting he sees followers who shouldn't be imagining that that's their role, but who's to tell someone that?
Well, everybody imagines that's their role, don't you think? I mean, we all think that we can do a little better in the hierarchy, that we deserve to be in our boss's job, for instance. I think that's normal. That's part of this built-in concern with rank and status and hierarchy that we were talking about earlier. Yeah, so you have to, if you're the boss, you know, Kevin, you mentioned earlier that there's this tension. You have to recognize that as a boss, that, you know, you're dealing with people who may actually be better at certain parts of the job than you. And you have to go back and forth and not be, you know, too brutal and know when you have to give way. And it's a very delicate little dance.
But do apes always know at every point in the hierarchy who's on top, who's beneath? Is it that clear? Do our instincts, should they speak to us that way?
No, they're not always that clear. Things can be confused. You know, there's also tension there where you have subordinates and alphas going back and forth about, you know, what's appropriate behavior. You have alliances, often alliances of females who are saying, you know, this is not acceptable. You got to stop doing that. They say it somewhat less articulately. They make these wah barks. Wah!
Oh, yeah, right. I've heard those.
It's a cry of outrage. Yeah. And so, you know, that dynamic between subordinates and superiors is everywhere in the primate world.
Let's get one more call. Jim is calling from Chicago. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that there's a difference between what your work environment is, whether your work environment, say, a bank versus, say, sales and telecommunications, on how your bosses treat you, how things happen, and the hierarchy.
So does it apply no matter where? Richard Conniff, what do you say?
Well, I'm curious, Jim, how do your bosses treat you? And what's your work circumstance?
I have to admit that my male bosses have always treated me much better than my female bosses. But again, I think you had pointed out that female bosses were more supportive, and that's just not my experience. I've talked with other people who have, you know, not had good experience with female bosses, but it all depends on the environment. I mean, you know, are you working at a nursing home or are you working at an automobile dealership? It really just depends. And I think you have to live in the now, you know, what's going on right now versus, when I was coming out of college, I went based on books that I read, say maybe Tom Peters' book, but that didn't apply to a bank I worked at.
Right, we got it. You and a whole lot of others. Richard Conniff, in a way, this brings us to the basic question here, is how universally do you think these lessons you want to draw from the primate world apply? I mean, can you always just, you know, lay them on like paint?
I wouldn't say you lay them on like paint, but you need to be aware that these impulses that we've been talking about are there in all of us in every workplace situation. They may take different forms. It depends not just on the type of company, but on the individual company, you know, the way these things play out. But things like gossip as a positive force, you know, that's everywhere. Things like conflict as a natural part of the work environment, that's everywhere. Hierarchy is everywhere. So, you know, I do think these things are universal.
And with all the time you've spent, who do you think's more effective in the end? Humans go to the moon. Apes don't. are we as good as they at just getting along, making things happen?
Yeah, I think we are. I think we tend to think in every workplace situation that it's worse than it really is. Humans are pretty successful, pretty social species. We take care of each other. You know, in our response to disasters like Katrina, that built-in empathy comes out, and we get together and we accomplish stuff.
Don't forget the ape within. Richard Conniff, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Richard Conniff, his new book is The Ape in the Corner Office, Understanding the Workplace Beast in All of Us. In a moment, primates love them, and so do humans, but our favorite banana is on the brink of extinction. We'll find out why. This is On Point. The particular yellow banana that Americans know and love, a variety called the Cavendish, is facing extinction and could disappear in 5 to 10 years. Like its predecessors, it is the hapless victim of a new strain of the fungus that causes Panama disease. Because of the Cavendish banana's genetic uniformity, the disease could wipe out entire plantations and take the banana, as we know it, off supermarket shelves for good. Dan Coppell has written about the disappearing banana and the battle to save it for Popular Science magazine. In this radio diary, he explains why the most popular banana is in danger of extinction.
The banana is the most popular fruit we eat by the pound. Now, there are people who will say, well, bananas have peels and you're weighing the peels. And that's true, but basically we eat about 25 pounds of bananas a year per person. That is about 10 pounds more than apples or oranges. It's a huge industry, and it's an industry that is a really fascinating one because the banana is a tropical fruit, and the idea that you could get a tropical fruit from where it's grown to temperate climates here and have it arrive intact, ready to be purchased, is really, really an amazing idea. And it's only something that's been possible in the past 100 years. And banana entrepreneurs who have a somewhat checkered history forced their way into the tropics, forced their way into U.S. markets, and invented a product that people didn't even understand how to eat when it first came out. There was an article in the Scientific American that actually instructed people how to peel a banana. And you can imagine some of the Victorians found it to be rather embarrassing.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
When the first kind of banana that we ate, the gros Michel, went extinct, the banana industry was really in denial for a long time. Banana companies almost went bankrupt because of it. And then ironically, once they adopted the new Cavendish banana, they almost went bankrupt because of an oversupply. Initially, what the banana companies and banana growers have done is they've just moved their plantations because the disease that hits bananas comes in the soil and it's expressed in the banana leaf. It destroys the banana leaf, which makes the banana impossible to ripen at the right rate, and the bananas rot on the vine very quickly. So the strategy until recently has been, well, this plantation, this plot of land is no good. We're going to move. And that works pretty well, except that it destroys a lot of rainforest. And in the end, you run out of space. It just doesn't work anymore. So it's only been very recently that they've begun to wonder what else can be done. In fact, Chiquita, until just 2 years ago, said that the way they were going to work at solving any kind of banana disease problem was strictly through chemical controls. They were not interested in trying to develop resistant bananas or trying to find new bananas that might resist these blights. And it has only been in the past year or so that the banana companies, and they're doing this very secretly, they won't discuss it, have begun to wonder, is there a replacement banana?
A beautiful bunch, a ripe banana. Daylight come and we want to go home. Hide the deadly black tarantula. Daylight come and we want to go home.
I think people who eat bananas, and that's everybody, should ask themselves a few questions. One is, how much do I value consistency? The banana companies will say that people need to eat these yellow bananas that are all the same, that all taste the same, pretty much look the same, ripen the same. Are we willing to say, well, we might define a banana a little differently? We might take a banana that tastes different. The second question people want to ask is, are they willing to accept a food product that is genetically modified? A lot of people are really uncomfortable with that. And although I understand that there's two sides to that issue, I would point out that a lot of the genetic engineers will say, hey, if we can build a resistant banana with radish genes, then we don't have to use a lot of pesticides. And that is really a plus. So it's not as simple as, yuck, that sounds gross, I don't want to do it. The question is, if we're going to lose the banana, we may have to do it. And this may be the product that requires us to really grapple with that issue, because up until now, we've pretty much been ignoring it.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch. Daylight come.
Dan Coppell is based in Los Angeles. He wrote the article, Can This Fruit Be Saved? For Popular Science magazine. Dan is now in China investigating the origins of the cultivated banana. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
All right, banana. Hide the deadly black tarantula.
Thank you. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.